Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and as promised last episode, we are at yet another party. This is the Paul Foote Awards, Private Eye's annual award for investigative and campaigning journalism. We're going to interview each and every one of the shortlistees in just a moment, but first, here is the chief of the judges, Padraig Reedy, talking about what a fantastic year it's been.
Well, it was such an astonishing year, and people have been saying to me all this evening, like, you know, how much work did you have to do? And you say, well, my work consisted of the spring sitting down and reading incredible journalism that's come in the past 12 months, and it's been an exceptional year. I know people say that every year, but really, you look at the shortlist this year, it really has been exceptional. So it was far from a chore. The only difficulty was really trying to whittle down to a long list and then to a short list, and then obviously the judges had incredible conversations and arguments and discussions about who could possibly pick to be a winner out of this.
It is amazing how much these stories change things. That seems to be a common theme in this year's shortlist. You know, they played into huge national conversations, and in many cases they sparked them.
Exactly, they didn't play into conversations, they created conversations. And you can have no better hope for journalism than that. You know, you look at BuzzFeed, we're miles ahead on the idea of, actual physical kind of attacks on people on Russians and former Russian spies in Britain. Madison Marriage completely changed the conversation with the Financial Times. You know, we all thought that the old kind of city cliche of, boorish kind of champagne swilling, gropey gentleman was over, but she revealed it's not. We haven't moved on at all. It still exists, and it exists right up to we had government ministers and best-selling children's authors at these dinners. Media gentlemen stories likewise. It was like changing the direction of a supertanker. For the first time in the past God knows how long, it is now unfashionable for a government to go out and say we are tough on immigration, because people realise there are human stories behind the rhetoric. Look, Sean O'Neill with Oxfam's like, no one would ever touch Oxfam. He said, well, no, I know something's gone wrong here, and it deserves to be examined, just like anything else. On it goes. So these were things that really changed how we talk about these ideas and really opened up conversations and made, I think, everyone who read them question the world they live in more. And that journalism can do no more than that.
I'm Madison Marriage, and I'm a reporter at the Financial Times.
Madison, what is the story that brought you here tonight?
I broke the President's Club story. For people who don't know, the President's Club is an all-male charity event that took place every January for the last 33 years. And in this January, I went in undercover as one of the 150-odd hostesses who are hired to work at the event.
So the story was absolutely enormous. I mean, and thank you for the pricey, although you would have had to be living in a box not to hear about it. What first drew your attention to it?
A friend who sometimes works as a hostess sent me a message last November saying, have you heard of the President's Club? I've heard it's disgusting. And I hadn't heard of it, and I spoke to colleagues and people in the market who I interview regularly, and nobody else seems to have heard of it either, which is odd because it attracts the creme de la creme from the business world. So it's definitely an event that's trying to stay under the radar despite the fact that it's raising money for children's charities.
Are you suggesting that some people might have known about it and not said anything to you?
No, well, we've had a few kind of contacts say after the reporting, oh, that's weird, I went to it 10 years ago. So, it was known about in kind of elite financial circles, business circles, but some of my colleagues were genuinely astonished at having covered business for 30-odd years, they'd never heard of it.
So the story was one of, I suppose, of widespread harassment of women kind of under contract. That was one of the most interesting aspects of it, that you were asked to sign away the rights to, the way people behaved around you.
So on arrival at the Dorchester Hotel where the event is hosted, every hostess was given a 6-7 page document to sign, a non-disclosure agreement, which in which you vowed never to speak about what took place that evening. You were given absolutely no time to read it. I was mentally trying to check who the signatories on the front page were, because that was important legally from a reporting perspective. But most women in that situation wouldn't have been thinking about that kind of thing. They would have just said, oh, okay. But I said out loud, do I need to sign this, knowing that I was recording it, via a covert device. And they kind of frowned at me, looked a bit pissed off that I was even asking the question, and said, yep, come on, hurry up. So, signed my name having not read it and handed it back in. And obviously that does help to kind of smother any discussion of what actually takes place at this event.
Can I ask how you gained access to the event in the first place? I mean, you're probably listed as a reporter on the FT.
No, so I applied under a fake name, fake identity, fake CV. It was actually kind of a mix of my genuine CV and someone else's. And I kind of melded the two together so that I could talk relatively consistently about everything I had on there. And I knew in advance of actually being selected as a hostess that I would have to go through an hour-long interview where I would be grilled kind of line by line on every aspect of my CV. So I literally went overboard on my homework and was kind of, my line was that I was an aspiring actress about to go to drama school and trying to save some money. And I'd come to this conclusion a bit later on in life, you know, having done a few jobs here and there. So I was literally kind of, you know, going through plays I hadn't studied in a decade to make sure that I understood who the characters were. So if I had to say, oh yes, that time I played Titania and I loved it, that I'd be able to do it.
That is unusual prep for an undercover journalist assignment, reading about, you know, reading up on your Shakespeare just in case you get grilled in the interview. So obviously, the story had a massive impact. The President's Club is it defunct now? Has it completely shut down?
It's in the process of winding down.
And what about the people who were behind the President's Club? What's happened to them? Have they set up something else? Are they in the process of doing that?
So it had three trustees. They've stepped down from a lot of their trustee roles at other kind of government organisations and charities. Not all of them. So some of them are still trustees of a couple of charities. The Charities Commission, the regulator, is about to publish its findings following an investigation into the President's Club, and the worst possible punishment it can issue is a permanent ban for those trustees from being trustees at any charity. It's unclear whether it will go that far. Apparently, I'm not sure it's ever been done before. So if that happens, it's quite a big deal.
Were you surprised by the scale of the reaction to it? Because it was a huge national discussion for days after the story broke.
Yes, I wasn't prepared for that scale, that type of reaction. So, for instance, you know, I've never been trolled before and I've never received hate mail before, and both of those things happened, and there was no way that I was anticipating that. I thought it would do well by FT standards, and it did well by kind of global standards. So, you know, I didn't expect it to travel as far as it did and to resonate with people as much as it did. But it really hit a nerve, I think, amongst people far and wide. My mum goes to Norfolk quite a lot, and she was visiting a haberdashery in North Norfolk, and two elderly women run this place, and they said, "You're not related to Madison Marriage." The second she walked in there, they were just, you know, she couldn't believe that they'd heard of me and had read this story. So really, it kind of went everywhere.
Well, congratulations on the story, Madison, and more undercover work in the offing? Probably can't ask that, can I?
With a wig and glasses, maybe.
This is an embarrassment of journalists to talk to. So here's the four strong team from BuzzFeed. I'll ask you to introduce yourselves.
Alex Campbell.
I'm Jane Bradley.
I am Tom Warren.
And I'm Richard Holmes.
The thrust of the story is that there are more than a dozen deaths on UK soil, which American intelligence has found reason to be suspecting that perhaps the Russian state is Russian-connected hitmen are involved.
Okay. How did this story come to your attention in the first place?
The origins of it is we received about 240 boxes of financial documents that we proceeded to scan. And so they told the story of a fixer, a financial fixer called Scott Young, who was a money man for the Russians. And from there, that story branched out to cover really a kind of wider international story of espionage, about how a network of individuals have been potentially were investigated to see if their deaths were linked to the Russian state.
People are often surprised to find that this investigation didn't start off being about Russia. Initially, it was all around Scott Young and this mysterious death that his family said wasn't properly investigated. And it was only kind of after looking into the wider cases and digging a bit deeper that we found this Russia link. So initially, it was never about Russia at all.
Can I just check I heard you right? 240 boxes of financial documents.
Indeed. And I was brought in as a straight out of university to look through every single one of them.
That is a classic first day at work job to be given, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was good fun. But then once you start reading and seeing what was actually in these things and speaking to the team and Heidi and Tom and Jane and Alex, you know, those 240 boxes went through so quickly because it's so exciting to sort of read the things we were reading about these people.
That seems like an extremely complex start to a story. And as you said, you were looking for something else in the first place. At what point did you realise that there was something else going on here? It was this person connected to Scott Young, this single death?
It initially started off with Scott Young, but it quickly grew to involve 9 other businessmen, which we called the Project Moscow Circle. So it started with Scott Young, and then we found these other businessmen, including the Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky, who were connected to this ill-fated property deal in Moscow. When millions had been ploughed in, the money went missing. Scott lost the money, and then these men all started dying within kind of years of each other. So it started off as that business circle about money laundering and Russian money. And then from that, we basically did a press clipping search of other suspicious deaths that may have been linked to Russia. And it went on from there. Alexander Perepolichny, the spy in the bag, the scientist behind Litvinenko's discovery of polonium. And it kind of just blew up from there.
Because you've got the freedom of, you know, length to tell a story at, obviously there are great advantages, but does it come with fallbacks to that too?
You can go slowly mad. It's the main disadvantage. But you have to resist that impulse. Things can feel unwieldy, but the other thing is we have a number of journalists to deploy on a story, and it was a transatlantic story. Alex at the time was in the US, so was our colleague Jason Leopold. So we have length of time, but we have an entire unit. So that kind of makes the length manageable. There's a kind of big crew of you all running at one thing, so it makes it quite an exciting adventure.
What happened after these 12 deaths? What have the legal consequences been for anyone who may have been involved? Have there been any?
Well, so after the story originally came out, there was outrage expressed from many sides, but little of anything occurred. But as the entire world now became aware, in March, Sergei Skripal was poisoned with nerve agents. And in the wake of that, our story gained new steam. There were immediate calls to review all of the deaths that we had looked into. And the government eventually said that they would begin their own review. We don't know what's going to come of that review, but it's ongoing. We also, the inquest into the death of Alexander Perepolichny was ongoing actually at the time that we reported the story. When the story came out, there were a number of things that we wrote about that didn't appear to be on the agenda at the inquest. Fast forward a few months later, and a key witness, the woman who spent some of Mr. Perepolichny's final hours with him, who had not been talked to by the police, she was now testifying at the inquest.
Well, that is a result, at least, and I guess we just wait to see where the story goes from here. Congratulations, guys. Enjoy the night.
Thank you.
I'm Gordon Blackstock, and I work for the Sunday Post. The story was about finding out how many deaths had been in Smilon Park Orphanage in the time it was opened between 1864 and 1981. There had been rumours about how many deaths there had been there for a number of years, but we were the first ones really to quantify that, and we did it through basically going through every death record in Lanark to find out how many deaths there'd been, which would be the first time there'd really been a sort of figure on that amount.
And did you say this was going up to 1981?
1981, yeah. Yeah. Predominantly the deaths were between the late 19th century and the 1950s.
And what was causing these deaths? Was there a dominant theme?
The deaths aren't explained in things like neglect, but that's probably something you derive at. That conclusion's probably somewhere you derive.
This is a very deep-rooted story, isn't it? Because it goes back, as you said, you know.
When I started looking at it, it was because the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry, which there's something similar in England, was looking at Smilon Park, and you had all these allegations of abuse, etc., etc. And I wanted to really get under the skin of what those allegations of abuse were, and also what had happened and where these kids have been buried.
And what's happened since the story was published?
First of all, the inquiry, the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry, they took our findings to look at them. They never looked at it. They took it and they submitted it as evidence as part of the inquiry.
So that's a sort of a tangible result which might contribute to the inquiry's findings in the fullness of time?
Yeah, it's a tangible result because, frankly, the order who ran the orphanage weren't interested in finding out how many deaths had been or where they'd been buried, and it was very unsettling for the relatives of loved ones who died there. I spoke to people in their 60s. They didn't know where their brother was buried. And, you know, that when it's questions like that, you've got that sort of emotive background. They were just looking for answers, and they weren't getting them. Have we got all the answers? I don't know if we've got all the answers, but we've certainly put them in the right path towards getting them.
What drew you to the story in the first place? Because a lot of journalists might have said, well, this is only running up to, you know, decades ago.
Yes.
And it's an old story.
Yes, of course. But even though it's so long ago, there's still people that are living with the aftermath of it. You know, there's still people who want to know answers and they're not getting anywhere. Frankly, these people are dying off. You know, there's people, when I started this investigation with the BBC, the guy who tipped me off died in between the 6 months I started and finished it. And his friend died as well. And these are people who campaigned and wanted to find out things, and they weren't getting the answers. So what drew me to it? It was a good tip-off, it was a good story, and I just tried to get answers to the people that were wanting them.
Gordon, thank you very much.
I'm Amelia Gentleman, and I work for The Guardian. This is a series of stories about Windrush and the people who came to Britain in the 1950s and 60s as children, who lived here for decades, legally working, paying their taxes, who in 2014 and afterwards began to get a number of alarming letters from the Home Office describing them as overstayers or essentially as illegal immigrants. A lot of them lost their jobs, lost their homes. Some of them were put in detention. And this is the story about why that happened and what happened next.
When did you get involved with the story?
So I got an email in October from a charity in Wolverhampton called the Refugee and Migrant Centre in Wolverhampton about a woman called Paulette Wilson, who'd been in Britain for 50 years and had worked here, had a good job, had been a taxpayer for 35 years. She'd arrived from Jamaica when she was 10. 3 or 4 years ago, she also had got a letter from the Home Office saying that she was somebody who wasn't here legally. And as a result of that, she lost her flat. And in the end, she was sent to Yarlswood Detention Centre.
When did you first realise that this was not just an isolated case?
So when I met her, the charity in Wolverhampton said that they'd seen one or two other similar cases of people who'd been here for decades being treated as illegal immigrants. Nobody else had been in detention, but they knew of other people who'd lost benefits. The day after we printed that story, I had a phone call from a man who said, you have to come and meet my dad, because he spent 5 weeks in detention for exactly the same reason. He's from Jamaica, he's been here for 50 years, always worked, always paid his taxes, and a few years ago he was told he was not here legally. When I went to meet that man, he told me that he'd got 3 friends from primary school who also were having similar difficulties. And so at that point, I knew it's a real problem.
So if it hadn't been for you writing that initial story, this might have taken a lot longer to come out, if it had come out at all, because a lot of these people didn't have, you know, access to journalistic resources, I guess.
I think there are quite a number of real problems. The first problem is that legal aid has been cut for immigration issues. So none of these people were able to get legal aid help. The other issue is that if you've been told by the Home Office that you're an illegal immigrant, the last thing that you do is tell anyone about it, and you really, really don't want to go and have your picture in the paper saying, look at me, I'm an illegal immigrant. So it was really, really hard to get people to talk about it. And it was strange because a lot of the law centres and a lot of the MPs' offices that you might have expected to know about it didn't really know about it. So it was something that was emerging week by week as more and more articles appeared in The Guardian.
Obviously, the story had an absolutely enormous impact. Is there more to come? Are there more cases that we don't know about?
I think there's a lot more still to come. We know that 60 people have been wrongly deported to the Caribbean. We don't know who they are yet or what's happened to them. We don't know how many people were wrongfully detained, either in immigration removal centres or in prisons. So, yeah, there's a lot more to still be found out.
Where would you like to see the story go next?
Well, we're looking at other aspects of hostile environment policies introduced by Theresa May in 2013, 2014, there were a whole package of measures that are beginning to have quite interesting expected or unexpected consequences. So we're going to be looking a lot more at that.
Does this all stem from the hostile environment policy? Is it all from May's time as Home Secretary?
I think that it's unusual to have a political scandal that is so clearly linked to the decisions of one single politician, and that politician is Theresa May. And although she's apologised repeatedly, she hasn't really had to answer for it because Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, really took the bullet for her.
Well, it's a fabulous story, and clearly there's a lot more to come out. Thank you so much, Amelia.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Cadwallader from The Observer.
So, Carol, what's the story that's brought you to the Pulford Awards?
Oh, the story is... what isn't the story? The story has been Cambridge Analytica, data, Facebook, and massive sort of overspending and shenanigans by the Leave campaign. And unravelling the way that all intersects has been the work of 18 months.
I think we're going to need to unpackage this a little bit. Where do you want to start?
It all started with a piece about Google, actually. Right at the start, I started looking at fake news and sort of like the way I discovered that Google's search engine had been gamed. And so that was when I started looking at the way that this academic mentioned this company to me, Cambridge Analytica. And everything really spun out from there. And what happened is that I mentioned Cambridge Analytica in the first piece, and then they started writing to me and saying, because I said they work for the Leave campaign, and they started writing to me and saying, no, we never work for the Leave campaign. And it was very peculiar, because all over the internet was evidence that they'd worked for the Leave campaign.
Right, so you've got this curious company, Cambridge Analytica, who seemed to have worked for the Leave campaign, and we think did. Where do we go from there?
We actually know they did. That has now been proven. They still haven't been found guilty of any offence in relation to it. But that's because of another part of the story, which is the fact that our electoral laws no longer work. So our electoral laws were sort of, they developed in the 19th century. And they absolutely don't cope with the online age of digital campaigning, which has only come in very, very recently. And what it means is we can't control money in our elections anymore.
So what exactly were Cambridge Analytica doing in relation to the Leave campaign? How were they working for them?
Well, we still haven't got to the bottom of it. The ICO, as a result of our investigation, the ICO seized the servers of Cambridge Analytica. And their report is coming out shortly, so maybe that will cast some light. But there is still so much clouded in darkness because essentially all of this spending that happened during the referendum went via the black boxes of these tech companies. So via Facebook servers and via Google servers. So we've got no way of tracking how much was spent. And the only people who can really tell us is Facebook. And they're refusing to answer questions in front of the Parliamentary Select Committee at the moment. So we're in a kind of standoff. I'm still trying to bring the fight anyway. So that's one of my...
All right, if I was a journalistic genie and I could grant you one access to one thing that you needed to carry on this story, what would it be?
Right now, I would be really, really curious to see what MI5 intercepted going in and out of the Russian embassy, according to emails.
What? Hang on a second, MI5 and Russian embassy, can you explain a little more?
Well, because we've just uncovered this cache of emails that the Leave campaign sent to the Russian embassy. And they are absolutely incredible and very clearly show a relationship between the Kremlin and Nigel Farage's Leave campaign. I found this out 2 weeks ago, and it's fascinating and really, really profoundly disturbing. And I want to know more about that.
This story is such a complicated one. There are so many strands. One can almost not tell where it begins and ends. How do you make it clear to readers what's going on?
I don't know. I can't ask that question. I try. I'm trying. That's all I can do. And it's kind of clear in my head now, and so I try and separate it out into smaller chunks and to keep going. But it's there's a real failure, frankly, of other news organisations to do their own, I mean, there's a massive news vacuum in this country. Private Eye fills a little bit of it. We're filling a little bit of it. But, I've been one journalist at The Observer on it. And there's a few people dotted around, you know, like Open Democracy have been doing stuff. And there's an ex-copper who's been doing stuff. I mean, it's like a crazy band of amateurs. Really is. And it's like, it really, you know, I'm on this accidentally. I'm not an investigative journalist. I was a feature writer and I stumbled into this. And I've just had to keep going. But I kind of really wish that the professionals had also sort of like turned up and started digging.
Where next?
It's just there's more to come. It's like we haven't got to the bottom of it by any stretch of the imagination. So,
well, congratulations on the story.
Thanks very much.
Sean O'Neill from The Times. Earlier this year, we exposed the cover-up by Oxfam of serious sexual abuse and misconduct by its senior aid workers in Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake.
So this was a story that is 7 years after the fact that you started getting involved with it. What was the first point at which you got involved with it?
I was approached by a source almost a year before we broke the story, expressing deep concern about issues at Oxfam that were being covered up and that should be exposed. But that source was a very, very nervous person, very concerned about their career and their, you know, what the work that they did, felt that exposing this kind of misconduct would damage the work. So it took a long time to, if you like, cultivate that source and persuade them to talk to me.
Is it more difficult researching stories which are not historic? I mean, 7 years is hardly history, but it is several years ago, and therefore people might have forgotten key events or you know, things like that. Is it harder?
It was hard, but it was a very vague story for several months until, if you like, we moved from source number one to source number two, who was in possession of a large number of documents, and that kind of lifted it very much into the present, because you had a large number of documents that proved the misconduct, and then you had a massive question of why this was not reported to government, police, authorities here or in Haiti. So you had a scandal and then you had a cover-up of the scandal.
I think a lot of people who see stories don't really realise that someone might have been working on it for a year. And sometimes I presume there are stories that don't pan out. You never find that second source.
Yes. There are lots of those, but you try and forget them. But yeah, I mean, you kind of, they're the ones that niggle away at you. I did this while doing lots of other things as well. Like, I covered Grenfell and all the aftermath of that. So this was almost a side project until maybe the last 4 months, when it started to click into place, when you had source number two, the documents led me to two or three other people who were able to verify parts of the documents. And you feel like lucky because you got, we were absolutely certain about bottoming out two or three or four people with it. But there are lots of stories where, I mean, I've got another story that arose in the aftermath of that is just not going to work because the people are too nervous to go public about it.
Was this a story that moved in an unexpected direction? One quite common theme that we've heard is people started looking into one thing and then suddenly something else arose. Or was the story pretty much as we saw it when it first came to you?
No, it started as, about last October we did another story about Oxfam, about an assault on an Oxfam country director in Nigeria who was then sacked in the aftermath, and there was a cover-up there. And this story, kind of the final story, came in on the back of that, if you like. So stories beget stories, I find. If you do one story, it tends to lead to another story. And I think the Oxfam story will lead to more stories as well.
I mean, it's been an enormous story, and there's been a lot of fallout from it. Is there a result that you'd like to see emerging from the story?
I think what I'd like to see is that sector, which has been, if you like, cosseted and protected, face up to the culture that has festered in there, and realise that culture has to change. And I think there is a political will in the UK, but also overseas, to make that happen. And I think it stretches way beyond Oxfam, right across the sector, and particularly in the UN. I mean, the UN is an extraordinary organisation with all sorts of legal immunities that protect people, and it's Oxfam is just the tip of the iceberg. But you know what? One thing I would say about this story is, and that this whole sector, there's an extraordinary code of silence around the whole place. It's amazing. Breaking that down is extraordinary.
Well, good luck with whatever comes next. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thanks.
I'm Emma Yeomans from London Student.
And I'm Ben Banamurva from London Student.
So, can you tell me a bit about the story that's got you this special commendation tonight?
So, I was graced with a tip-off that there was a dodgy professor at Cambridge going to a dodgy conference at UCL, which is my university. And after a couple of months of investigating it, we found out that Toby Young was one of the attendees. And it just so happened that that was the week that Mr. Young was making the news for his comments on eugenics after his appointment to the Office for Students. And so we rushed the story to the Private Eye.
And Emma, you were actually at Private Eye doing work experience in the week that this was all going on. And this was your story, both of your story, from the off.
Yes, I was on work experience for a week and I knew Ben had this. And I had to sort of check with Ben and say, Ben, we're talking about Toby Young here. Shall I just pitch it? Should we do it this way? It's very exciting, though, because to have the Eye on board, because London Student has no real revenue or backing or any resources. So to have the backing of the Eye was actually the only way we would have been able to run it. I think it's also worth saying that this is the second news story Ben has ever written. He'd only just joined London Student. So it's been quite a big year, really.
Can I ask what the first one was?
The first story that I wrote? I think I wrote some piece on the student rent strikes, but it wasn't a scoop.
I think it can be said that your story essentially claimed Toby Young's scalp. There have been a lot of stuff about his tweets. I think the eugenics conference was the thing that tipped it over the edge.
There's no scalp I'd rather take.
Well, the audience have all filed in now, so let's go over to Ian Hislop, Private Eye's editor, announcing the winner of this year's Paul Foot Award.
Good evening, everybody. As they say at Labour Live, there are thousands of you. Look at all those full seats behind you. So, Paul Foot, incredible journalist, and the things I learnt from him, apart from everything, was firstly the cover-up to the story is always worse than the crime in the story. We see that in the Oxfam story on the shortlist, the charity, the Gordon Blackstone story about the Catholic Church. People saying, we're the good guys. If you run the story, it'll damage us, so we cover it up. And it's never half the damage that the cover-up causes, rather than the admission of the crime. Same in the Windrush. The Windrush story, extraordinary single narratives, and that's another thing I learned from Paul, is don't give us all the data, give us the story. In this country, we suddenly said, you know, immigration, the top story. Well, we don't like immigrants. We've got far too many immigrants. Oh, you don't mean nice Afro-Caribbean nurses, do you? They're not immigrants. We love them. Get the story, and you can just turn people's attitudes. It was an extraordinarily effective story. His other thing was people often used to say to him the story, well, this is a story for the police. This is a story for someone else. Why are you doing this? The answer was, well, no one else is, so why don't I? And again, we've got that in the story about Russian interference in the democratic process here. I love the fact that in America they have a special prosecutor and a whole arm of government is looking into the Russian connection. Over here we've got, oh, can someone from the Observer do it? On her own. So it is great to feel that journalism in that sense is still doing a job. We've all said it, people say it every year, it was such a strong shortlist, but this really is stunning. All of those essentially redefined public debate in their area. So it was incredibly difficult to find the winner. But the judges decided that the winner was Amelia Gentleman for Windrush.
Thank you. Firstly, thank you to you. I'm so thrilled to have won this award because Private Eye is literally the publication that I feel most excited about coming out every fortnight. I go to the newsagents, I feel happy when it's the right Tuesday. It's an amazing publication and I'm so happy to have won the award. I don't think any of my editors are here, but I'd like to thank them because... anyway... Because although it's true that The Guardian's finances are still not totally where we'd want them to be, it is nevertheless an amazing place to work. And I think I couldn't really perhaps have done this work anywhere else because the paper really does treat this kind of story very, very seriously and allowed me to kind of go off and do lots of interviews over the space of 6 months without really questioning, you know, where I was going or what it was all for. And that's an amazing, amazing environment to work in. I just want to say well done to all of the other competitors as well, because their pieces were incredible and they should really all have won. And finally, to say to all of the people who let me interview them over the last 8 months, an enormous thank you, because it's quite something to ask somebody who's been cast as an illegal immigrant to agree to be interviewed on the record, to have their picture in the paper under a headline that says illegal immigrant. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do, but it was so amazing that they all were so brave. And as a result of that, I think now something like 1,800 people have been given documents that they didn't have before, and it's incredible.
So that's it from the Paul Foot Awards. Congratulations again to Amelia and to all the rest of the shortlistees. We will be back again in 2 weeks with another episode. We'll see you then. Goodbye.